Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. We call this the Left in the Lurch show. I read a article that indicated that insurers were being left in the lurch, and I thought about what the lurch was, and out came this show, which I am very proud of. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio. Here, a person who would never leave you in the lurch, from the University of Kentucky Physician Assistant Program, Assistant Professor Shelly Irving. Hi, Shelly.
Hello.
And a person known oftentimes by his nickname of Lurch, from the University of Kentucky. He is the Interim Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure. To tell you how to access Health Matters on the web, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hello, Tony. Is that good enough? I don't even remember how he went.
It's not bad. He was neat, sweet, and petite, and that certainly describes you as well.
Yeah, you have no idea. WMKY.org. What is that? Yes, that is Moorhead State Public Radio's website, and that is also where you can find all the shows, or at least the most recent shows on Health Matters. There's a link there to the audio in case you want to listen to them over and over again. They never get old, unlike Tony and I.
Definitely right? Getting old.
So, if you want to hear the audio, go to WMKY.org. Yes, you have to find your way through the menu. We did not give you the direct link straight to Health Matters. You're going to have to look at some of those other shows. After that, interact with Health Matters. Jump over to Facebook, do a search for HM Radio Show, or go to Facebook.com/HM Radio Show. Either way, you should find yourself on our fan page. There you can leave comments, leave feedback, let us know what you like, let us know what you don't like. There's all kinds of things you can do to interact with the show. We do monitor it. We do post things from time to time, stuff that goes on the show, stuff that's in the news, stuff that's relevant to healthcare. Sometimes it's just relevant. But anyway, become part of Health Matters by joining us on Facebook, facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Our sponsor for today's radio show.
Do we have one?
Yes, Appalachian.
You went through and found one?
Appalachians in Poverty. Those are the people who have, in fact, been left in the lurch. This was from Health Affairs. It was published online August 7th, talking about the growing gap, the growing difference in life expectancy between Appalachian people, especially lower income Appalachians, and the rest of the U.S. I put 9 key points. I'm going to go over 3 each segment so that you will be aware of the key points in this article in Health Affairs, August 7th. Key point number 1, life expectancy in Appalachia. From Mississippi to New York, that is, this is what we call Appalachia, northern Mississippi stretching all the way up to New York State. It lags behind the rest of the United States, and the divide is widening. Key point number 2, children born in Appalachia. From 2009 to 2013, they have a life expectancy of around 76.9 years, compared with 79.3 years, 2.5 years, roughly shorter, than the rest of the U.S. For the people who were born in the 1990s, that gap was narrower. It was only 7 months. So since 1990 up to 2009, children born in Appalachia have gone from a 7 month shorter life expectancy up to a 2.5 year shorter life expectancy on average. And key point number 3, people live longer today than they did a generation ago. That is, life expectancy in general is increasing. Infant deaths are rarer, but the problem is less rapid declines in infant mortality in Appalachia, coupled with slower gains in life expectancy, have contributed to a deep chasm in the survival odds in this region. Now, I will point out, when we talk about life expectancy in general, people are living longer than they did a generation ago. That's absolutely true. But if you look at the last couple of years in particular, the life expectancy has actually been declining in Appalachia. So we do not expect that gap to get any shorter. So in our opinion, people in Appalachia were left in the lurch. Now the question comes up then, what is a lurch? How do you get left in a lurch? And I looked it up on the Google. This was not a huge.
You looked it up on the line?
Yes. And this was not a huge intellectual investment on my point. But this is what I learned. There was a French board game in the 17th century called Lorche, or they also called it Lurch, similar to backgammon. And you suffered a lurch if you were left in a hopeless position from which you can't win. So we call left in the lurch as being a person who's in a hopeless position. Now, it seems odd that we still refer back to a 17th century board game for a hopeless position. I mean, you could say I was left in Windows 95. You know, that would be a non-winnable position.
Yeah, that's pretty dated. Left you could even go Windows XP.
Right. I was left in Houston without a paddle.
Right.
You know, that sort of thing. I was left in the Trump White House staff. Hopeless positions, positions from which you cannot win, would be the lurch. But why do we still refer to a board game in the 17th century? I was left on health matters with co-hosts who couldn't follow an argument. You know. Okay, the atmosphere just suddenly got tense here in the studio. And thank you.
I don't follow, Tony.
This moment of silence brought to you by Rick Phillips.
I don't follow
and
you.
Shelley Irving. Very nicely done, by the way. That was, I mean, they looked at each other. They said, okay, he's on his own on this one. Very nice, guys. I appreciate
it. We're trying to demonstrate a lurch, you know, object lesson.
We just left you in the lurch.
Speaking of that, I did want to give thanks as well to Glennis Board. Glennis is in West Virginia Public Radio. She wrote the Chigger song, I found out, that we sang last show. And if you did not hear the Chigger song, especially to start the third fractional portion, it was magnificent. It was absolutely magnificent. That will be 2 weeks ago by the time this show airs. Check back the Chiggers in Purgatory show. We sang the Chigger song. Thanks again to Glennis Board, West Virginia Public Radio, who wrote that song. I got it from Jen at the free clinic, and we proudly sang it on the show. At least two out of the three of us did. Next up, to talk about then the insurers who are left in the lurch. The problem with insurers in the United States right now is there is a cloud. These are the words of Modern Healthcare, September 9th, of political and regulatory uncertainty. The thing is, no one knows whether the Trump administration, at the time we go to air with this, is going to allow the federal government to support lower-income citizens in purchasing health insurance on the exchange, is going to help the insurance companies if they find that insuring a certain exchange is not profitable. Now, we had insurance co-ops when we started the Affordable Care Act. Due to political divisiveness, the co-ops were allowed to go bankrupt. That is, they were supposed to have risk corridors that would refund them if they got into deep trouble. They did get into deep trouble, and the risk corridors were not there, and they were allowed to go bankrupt. The business model changed as they were losing money. In the same way, now the insurance companies are concerned. If they do not have the support for low-income citizens to purchase the insurance products, then they may, in fact, lose even more money than they did. So whether or not the Trump administration decides to do this is going to determine whether or not the insurance exchanges will be viable. And so far, we're moving into the enrollment period with no signals at all whether they will or not. There are 8 states that have approved insurance rates for 2018. Interestingly enough, Kentucky is one of them, the only state in the South that has approved insurance rates changes. The Kentucky individual plan on the market increase is 48.6%.
That's high.
Somebody's getting left in the lurch.
They have approved that, and they may rise less than that, but there will probably be a substantial rise, as several insurers have reported difficulty in being profitable in the state of Kentucky. The small group plan, their rate increase is the approved percent change approved was 9.9% for the state of Kentucky. So the insurers, again, there will be significant rate increases because they have been operating at a loss. Whether or not the Trump administration then supports lower-income people purchasing insurance will determine how profitable they will be or will not be. And that is really yet to be determined. The insurance companies, in fact, are in the lurch. Next up, another group in the lurch, the families of people with dementia. This was Reuters Health, August 28th, the average lifetime cost of care after a diagnosis of dementia in the United States, about $322,000. Families pay for around 70% of that. That's over $225,000 lifetime costs for care of a person with dementia. It was originally reported in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society, August 17th. Dementia, one of the costliest diseases, most of the responsibility falling on families. The Medicaid, Medicare cover 14% and 16% respectively. Most of this stuff is home care, house sitting of a person with dementia, extra supplies and so forth that you have to do, time off work and so forth. That is what the costs are.
Do you think the expense to families is going to go up in light of the insurance information you just shared with us?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't see the insurance people are not going to take on more responsibility. They, over the past couple of years, and I think our fans know, I am not particularly a fan of insurance companies, but the numbers say that they have lost a substantial amount of money through the Affordable Care Act, particularly on the exchanges where there are sicker people, people who have pre-existing conditions that could not get group employer insurance. So I do not expect them then to be very generous with their benefits, and we'll talk more about that in our second fractional portion. So I expect it's going to get higher. The expense, you know, you worry about, of course, you'll get called away from work. Who's going to take care of your elderly loved one who may be developing dementia? What if they have to quit their job? Who's going to take the keys away? You don't think about the fact that you're going to plow a lot of money into those care, into their care. And I have my mother is starting to show some signs. She lives away, about 3 hours away. We're driving. We're trying to spend time with her. We've worked on trying to help her with her finances and so forth. And it takes a lot of time, effort, energy, and also it's costing. Yeah, it's out-of-pocket expenses. An insurance company is certainly not going to pay us to drive down there and check up on her. That number just seems so astronomical. You think, well, no one could afford mm-hmm. to pay $200,000 mm-hmm. out of pocket.
No. Your house doesn't cost that much, typically.
Right. Particularly here in eastern Kentucky, you can buy a pretty nice place for much less than $200,000, and you finance that over 10 to 15 years.
Or 30.
Yeah. And so this is money that's going to come either in lost productivity or out of pocket for expenses. And these are expenses that are not typical insurance expenses. They mentioned it does not – actually, this did not talk about missed work and missing school or inability to take a promotion or a job, but it was direct expenses relating to either hiring caregivers or buying medical equipment or actual expenses related to it. Now, they mentioned more than 5 million Americans live with dementia currently, and that could rise to 16 million by 2050. Rick is not – you may remember from a couple of weeks ago, Rick was not fond of 2050 target things. You remember your scorn at dermatologists. Well, but still, we've got a lot of work to do on dementia.
Tony, I mean, the only thing that's going to be happening then is health matters will probably still be going. And it'll have the same number of listeners.
the same exact ones, probably.
Well, I mean, yeah. But they won't remember they listened to it.
Right.
No, but if those radios are set to automatically come on, then we're good, right? Those
well, they have radios and 2050?
No. Do you think? I think not.
No, I don't agree. I think not. I think, well, No, they will have them. They will have them.
They'll
have something like them.
One thing we know for sure, we're going to have radios in the next 5 minutes. So you keep your radio tuned to this station and come back with us after the break. We're going to take a break now, refresh ourselves, and try to get out of the lurch that we find ourselves in. And you do the same and come back. You're listening to Moorhead State Public Radio, where health matters.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Left in the Lurch show. We are talking about lurches. It turns out lurch was a board game in France in the 1700s. And if you were in the lurch, you could not win the game. You simply were too far behind to win. And that's where it came from. I would not think that the average person on the street would know what a lurch is, but now you do. And you're welcome.
I don't know. Should we thank him or what?
I don't know yet. I don't know. Let's wait till the end of the show.
Our sponsor for the second time, a group of people left in the lurch, and that is Appalachians in Poverty, left in the lurch because the life expectancy of people in Appalachia has always been less than those in the rest of the U.S., but that discrepancy, in fact, is growing. We're up to key point number four. Key point number four, the growing disparities in infant mortality and life expectancy are surprising, says Gopal Singh, who's a researcher at Health Resources and Services Administration in Rockville, Maryland. Smoking-related diseases accounted for more than half of the life expectancy gap. You would think if there is a gap in life expectancy, it preferentially affects people who are poorer and uneducated. And it is half of it is caused by smoking. You would say to yourself, well, gee, I bet those people in Kentucky are doing absolutely everything they can right now to do something about that. And those of you who've listened to Health Matters know that, no, they're not. An indoor smoking ban, increasing the tax on cigarettes, raising the minimum smoking age to 21, all those things would save lives in Kentucky. None of those things are being done. But there it is. Rockville, Maryland, Gopal Singh says more than half of the life expectancy gap between Appalachia and the rest of the country is caused by smoking-related diseases. Here's key point number five, higher mortality from heart disease, lung cancer, respiratory disease, diabetes, kidney problems, suicide, accidental injuries, and drug overdoses all contribute to the widening survival disparities. Now, I would point out, you know, you think, well, I really thought that the drug overdoses, you take out a few 20-year-olds, and that's going to really drop your life expectancy. But the number of people affected by the smoking-related illnesses really dwarfs that. And so I think you start to lose a lot of people a little bit early in their 40s and 50s, and that it accounts for more of the disparity than the drug overdoses. But again, they all add together, and people here die young. And key point number six, in the early 1990s, infant mortality rates were similar to those in the rest of the U.S. Deaths declined in the region and in the nation, but the infant mortality did not decline as fast. Our infant mortality rates in Appalachia are 16% higher than the rest of the country. All right, so you ask yourself.
No, I don't.
He writes memos.
That's an inside joke for the radio audience is not going to know about, but it was pretty funny.
Rick, as a part of his educational program, is required to write memos. And Rick has written some beautiful.
Job.
Well, I know you write memos, but we all do. That's not the
point.
When
was the last time you wrote a memo? Honestly, on a piece of paper, actually put to, from. When was the last time you actually did a properly formatted memo to your staff?
Properly formatted. See, you're putting all these qualifiers in. Did I properly format the memo to my staff? I don't know. I sent an email to all the staff. That doesn't count.
That's not a memo.
That's not a memo. You, on the other hand, are the memo expert. Well, how? I mean,
I don't know that I would call it an expert, but I have gotten pretty good grades so far. I can write a mean memo.
All of you are proud of Rick for writing memos. Just let us know on our Facebook page how proud you are of Rick for being able to write memos. You know, it's really hard. I want you to understand. This is from this is from Health Affairs, September 5th. And it is not anything to laugh about.
He's going to get through it, Shelley. He's going to get through it.
Honestly, this memo thing is just blown up on me. They pointed out that more than 2.4 million women in Appalachia and rural hospitals in general across the country have lost obstetric service. 9% of rural counties lost hospital obstetric services between 2004 and 2014. Over 10 years, 9% of rural counties lost their obstetric services. In all, 45% of rural U.S. counties had no hospital obstetric services at all between 2004 and 2014, and we dropped an additional 9%. Rural counties with lower median household incomes, higher populations of black women, those located in states with lower Medicaid income eligibility limits for pregnant women were the most likely to lose or have no obstetric services. More than half the births in rural areas are paid for by Medicaid. Medicaid does not pay terribly well. And so, studies found that women who must travel longer distances to receive obstetric care have lower rates of participation in prenatal care. I mean, again, if you have to drive, then you're less likely to get good prenatal care. You're less likely to get the expert obstetric care, more likely to do emergency deliveries. And so, women in rural areas have higher rates of hospitalizations due to complications from their pregnancy, and we have a higher infant mortality. So what we are doing then in rural, particularly in rural Appalachia, I'm going to focus on this, and I apologize to our out-of-state listeners, but this is the thing that really drives me, is we are creating an environment where young families cannot come. we are in effect emptying out rural Appalachia by refusing to support it. And we talked about that then. The insurance companies not having support from the federal government are not going to write the policies, not going to stay on the exchange. We are losing services because the hospitals cannot receive compensation, or because due to our sparse population, you can't have a high enough concentration of providers to provide them. Let's face it, if you only need one obstetrician, that obstetrician then has to be on call all the time, and that's not the lifestyle that an obstetrician would want. So a little frustration there on my part. We are creating an environment where people cannot live, young people cannot stay. We lose our young people in rural Kentucky, and particularly in rural Appalachian Kentucky, and our population diminishes, our future diminishes. And this is kind of a policy decision, in essence, from several administrations to abandon the support for these areas. You think if you concentrate a group of people in poverty, you would then concentrate resources to help them. But in fact, in Appalachia, we have a concentrated group of people in poverty, and we are withdrawing resources, and that creates the disparity in life expectancy. All right, that's enough of a rant.
That wasn't much of a rant. I've written longer memos.
And better formatted with references, I might point out. Well, you live here and you wonder, what would it take? You know, why could we get to, if we had a grant program, if someone studied this more? And you look at this and you see that systematically, you know, we are changing our, even now, we are changing for the worse, the living conditions in Appalachian Kentucky. And it's being done systematically. It's not something that, what could we do about this? We need to provide basic services, obstetric services, healthcare services, and so forth. And we need to get our people off cigarettes. That's all there is to it. Sorry. Put that in. Rick, can you write a memo on that?
Done.
Write that. Okay.
Finished.
Thank you. A couple other things here while we're talking about people left in a lurch. One, this was August 7th. The title was Physicians Protest Harmful Anthem Emergency Care Coverage Policy. This was on several news wires. It was Reuters and others. Here's what the Anthem notices was sent to enrollees in Missouri. They said, save the ER for emergencies or you will be responsible for the cost. Going to the ER or calling 911 is always the way to go when it's an emergency and we've got you covered. But this started back in June. You will be responsible for the ER costs when it's not an emergency. That is, Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield has decided to review retrospectively, your emergency room visit. If it turns out, in their opinion, it wasn't an emergency, you pay the ER fee. Now, the interesting thing about this, the Missouri Medical Association and the AMA ask Anthem to rescind their policy. This policy has been in effect in the state of Kentucky since 2015. I know, and I looked. I actually looked. I said, well, what has Kentucky done about it? And not much, I'll be honest. The AMA, the American College of Emergency Physicians, the Medical Association of Georgia, because this is going into effect in Georgia, the Association of Physicians in the state of Missouri, all of these have protested. There is one name missing from that. It's in place in Georgia, Kentucky, and Missouri. Will be implemented in Indiana starting September 1st. First rolled out in Kentucky in late 2015. The Kentucky Medical Association, Kentucky's, the people who are supposed to protect Kentuckians have been reasonably silent on this. I was not aware of this until it hit Georgia and Missouri. And I thought it was time to bring it to our show. You need to be aware of this. If you have an Anthem insurance policy, if you go to the emergency room, if subsequently they decide you didn't really have an emergency, then you pay for the emergency room visit.
So how's the patient going to know when to go and when not to go if they don't find out till after the fact?
Well, the Georgia Medical Association, the AMA, said, well, there's something called the prudent layperson. This is the way we've always done it. If a reasonable person thought this might be an emergency, then it's an emergency. And, in fact, that's the way the Affordable Care Act was set up, to allow for the prudent layperson to make those decisions, not the insurance company. The insurance company cannot second-guess a prudent layperson.
But is that going to actually hold true? I mean, will the insurance companies are going to want a say in this?
I think I'm perfectly fine with them restricting coverage on some things, but to second guess your judgment about going to the emergency room, to review a written record and decide that whatever fear or panic you felt was not appropriate.
I mean, yeah, this thing has catastrophe kind of written all over it. I mean, people are not going to go because they'll be scared. People are going to go and get billed. And you know, of course, in Eastern Kentucky, that's the acute care clinic.
Right? It is.
I mean, that's what we've basically over the last 20 years. If you have trouble, you know, that's happened. I mean, let's be honest. 2/3 of the day happens outside of the workday. Right? If you're you don't have much choice but to go to the ER. Is the only urgent care center that's open 24 hours a day.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, there was a study published in the, I believe it was, Shelley, help me out with this, it was the AMA Journal, I believe, it could have been the AMA Journal of Internal Medicine, that said that the ER visits that have been deemed to be avoidable are due to mainly to mental health issues and dental issues. That is, if you go to the emergency room with a abscessed tooth, the ER can't pull your tooth, so that would have been an avoidable visit. Even though they set you up with a dentist, they may have given you some antibiotics or done something like that. And the same way with mental health, they cannot begin to treat your mental health in the emergency room, but they can make arrangements for it. And in that regard, gee, that's unnecessary. You should have just called the mental health provider yourself and avoided that. So you are, in effect, when you say, I'm not going to pay for it unless the emergency room did something worthwhile, then you are going to be focusing and targeting people with mental health ER visits. And you're right, targeting people in rural areas because they have no alternatives.
And these are the same insurance companies that aren't offering coverage to these individuals for their mental health or their dental health. They're not reimbursing enough for there to be providers to take care of these individuals. And now the insurance companies have medical decision making. Correct?
Yes. Well, they are attempting then through their payment system to create, as you said, medical decision-making. Now, I want you to understand what Shelley just said. We have decided that physicians and healthcare providers, other healthcare providers, can make these decisions. They are liable for. If you make a bad decision on a patient, then you may be legally liable about that. The insurance companies, they are not, in their opinion, making a decision about whether you should come to the emergency room or not, just simply saying, well, if you didn't do it right, you pay out of pocket. So they would argue they're not making a decision. They're simply altering the terms of payment, and then you have to make a good decision yourself as to what you think they might or might not pay for. Let's soak in for a minute.
Disaster.
I will point out, instead of the AMA Journal, it was the Journal of Quality in Healthcare. I apologize for the wrong reference there. But they did point out avoidable emergency room visits, and this was strictly aimed at this Missouri, Georgia, Kentucky thing, that the avoidable visits are mental health and dental health, and those are things that they will be targeted if you decide you're not going to pay for visits that you determine are avoidable. Next up, also from Anthem, good news, Indianapolis-based Anthem has stopped covering outpatient MRIs and CT scans at hospitals without prior approval. What this means, now, if you're from a rural area, the only imaging center in most rural areas is in the basement of the hospital. They do inpatients, but they also do outpatients. Anthem wants its members to avoid hospital imaging services and instead go for a cheaper alternative at a freestanding facility. Great news. There are no freestanding facilities in rural Kentucky. That means you're going to have to drive to a city in order to get your MRI scan or CT scan.
So are they picking up the gas bill and that I have to take off work and my meals I'm going to have to get because I'm traveling?
Right. And if you want that MRI for back pain, you're going to bounce along the interstate to get your MRI scan. Or if you have difficulty breathing, you're getting a CAT scan and so forth. Hospitals will need to submit a pre-certification request for any patient receiving an MRI or CT at the hospital. The imaging service will only be covered if Anthem deems the request medically necessary. Policy took effect July 1st in Indiana, Wisconsin, Missouri, and Kentucky. On September 1st, they're going into Ohio. Not sure how much money they will save. Again, there is a FAQ on Anthem's website. If you are getting your insurance from Anthem, I'll tell you what's happening here. They're setting up for an exit from the state of Kentucky. They're putting terms and terms and terms. on it that make their insurance essentially unworkable.
Useless.
Yeah, make it useless. They are second-guessing your doctors on their imaging. And I understand, you know, it may very well be cheaper to go to a freestanding facility. And you cannot, as a consumer, you cannot tell how much it's going to cost to get an MRI or a CT at most of these facilities. Is very difficult. The costs are hidden. We've talked about this before. These costs were negotiated with insurers. The actual price that the hospital list is discounted by 40% or 50% by the insurers. So whatever the price is, if you ask it, it's not the price. It's not the amount of money that the hospital actually gets paid. It's a negotiating tool. It is an opening position that the hospital takes, not the final cost. The problem is, if you have to ask the hospital can't tell you the discounted price because then the insurer would discount 50% of that, and the price would keep shrinking and shrinking. So,
and no two hospitals are going to necessarily have the same negotiated cost.
Right. Right. So every hospital negotiates with insurance companies because they hold all the cards. They put up a price as a negotiating tool. The insurance company accepts that price but immediately discounts it, and that discounted price is what they actually pay, except – if you ask how much would it cost to get the MRI scan, they have to tell you that full price because the insurance company insists on the discounts. It's a complicated system. But at this point, Anthem has gone a step further and said, look, we don't care what the price is. We think that, in the most part, the imaging centers are cheaper. And I think there is a cynical wink and a nod behind that, that also, if you have to drive to Lexington to get your image, you probably won't do it. So they're counting on reducing demand by simply moving the imaging center farther away from you. And, you know, just about the time I made my peace with insurance companies, this sort of...
You've never made your peace with them.
I hate insurance companies. But they did lose money on the Affordable Care. They actually were left in the lurch by the Affordable Care Act and by the continuing partisan bickering over whether or not the federal support of the Affordable Care Act for insurance companies was going to take place. They lost hundreds of millions. The big ones did. Don't feel sorry for them. They made profits on their – they make so much money on their other endeavors, they're fine. But they did lose money on insurance, and right now they don't know whether the government is going to continue the current system or not, and they're supposed to pony up and decide they're going to cover people in different states before the enrollment period in November with no idea of the terms of that coverage. So they – in essence, the insurance companies become much like you. They're doing their healthcare business without knowing exactly how much it's going to cost, which maybe that's a taste of their own medicine. I don't know. Take a taste of your own medicine. Take a taste of something else. We really don't care. But you should take a break. We will, too. We'll come back with our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Left in the Lurch show, and we had a brief executive committee meeting during the break and determined that I was talking too much and I was getting too mad about people in Appalachia being left in the lurch. So what we're going to do is we're going to leave them in the lurch, this fractional portion, and just go on and talk about fun stuff, happy stuff.
Do you ever bring that stuff onto the... When was the last time we rammed a barge into a bridge?
Got some fun, happy stuff here. But our sponsor, first of all, not fun, not happy, Appalachians in Poverty, Left in the Lurch. We are talking about Health Affairs Online, August 7th. The gap in life expectancy, the widening gap in life expectancy between Appalachian people, particularly poor Appalachian people, and the rest of the country. And I've got three more key points to talk about. Key point number 7, people born in the poorest areas in Appalachia, by the end of the study period, had a life expectancy of 75.1 years, again, compared with 79.9 years for the rest of the low-poverty areas. Black men born in the poorest parts of Appalachia had a life expectancy of 70.4 years. That's more than a decade fewer years on this planet than wealthier white women. Key point number eight, the relationship between poverty and life expectancy is stronger in Appalachia than the rest of the United States, says Gopal Singh, who is the researcher at the Health Resources and Services Administration in Rockville. He said, poverty can lead to mental stress. It forces people to live in social environments that could put them at risk for poor health and poor outcomes. And he listed all the things that happens when you're poor, which is a lot of stuff. Key point number nine, it is possible that poverty may be a stronger predictor of poor health in Appalachia than the rest of the country because of the high concentration of poor people in the area. This is Jennifer Montez, sociology researcher at Syracuse, wasn't involved in the study. It's one thing to be poor, live in a mixed-income area in a community that's socially integrated with access to amenities that promote a healthy lifestyle. It is entirely different being poor in an area where destitution is all around. The idea of being – we concentrate poor people, and as I said, rather than concentrating the resources to help the poor people, in fact, the resources are more diffuse than they would be in a wealthier community that just had – was visited by a few poor people. That is our sponsor, the Appalachians in Poverty, Left in the Lurch. Next up, absolutely fascinating. You've got to have an opinion on this one. Our two whipping boys, if you want to call them that, on this show are insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies. These are the ones that we don't like.
I thought it was ATVs and trampolines.
Yeah, but
that's
not
only if you're not wearing a helmet.
All right. This was on the advisory board reported September 12th. Drug maker Allergan, they make eye drops. They announced that they had transferred the patents for their best-selling eye drug, it's called Restasis, you've heard of it on TV, to the St. Regis Mohawk Tribe. They transferred the patent for their best-selling eye drug to the Mohawk Tribe. Brings in $336.4 million in the second quarter of 2017. So $1 billion a year drug. The patents transfers to the Mohawk Tribe. Now, you might ask why.
Why? Why would that be?
Why would they transfer? Well, here's the reason. Several generic drug makers have sought to invalidate their patents for Restasis. Now, there's two ways you can do this. You can challenge them in court. But the other thing is there is a review process called the IPR process at the patent office. It was created 6 years ago as a faster, low-cost alternative to determining patent validity through the courts. So there are two ways you can attack a patent for a very profitable billion-dollar-a-year drug. Allergan has argued that in federal court in Texas that the six patents they have on Restasis should not expire until 2024. According to the Wall Street Journal, the rivals argue that it should not have been granted the patents in the first place, and they should be ruled invalid. Now, think about this then, though. So we've got two pathways here. They got to defend this in court. They also got to defend this through this IPR review process to defend the patents. So if they transfer them to a Native American tribe, these federal regulations do not apply. They have sovereign immunity as a Native American tribe. So they're going to pay.
Goes along with their casino business.
It does, in fact. They're going to pay $13.75 million for the tribe. They'll pay them that while they're taking in $336 million a quarter. And eventually, the tribe will receive $15 million annual royalties every year while holding the patent and keeping it protected from federal review via the IPR process. CEO Brent Sanders said the company made the move to make sure we can defend these patents in only one forum. We're open to having them adjudicated in the federal courts. We don't think that you should have that second pathway. This has happened before, apparently. University of Florida argued that it was a university-owned patent shouldn't be challenged because it's a state institution and should have sovereign immunity. But this is the first time a drug company has used a Native American tribe. It looks like one associate professor at New York Law School's Innovation Center said, barring some radical change, it looks like they just checkmated everybody. And so I fully expect drug companies will start transferring patents to Native American tribes and give them royalties to keep the patents out of the federal review process.
How is that any different than moving them to, like, say, offshore? Because I would think that what they're essentially doing is they're moving away from the federal limitations and guidelines and rules and regulations. All that. You can do the same thing by moving offshore. I'm surprised somebody hasn't done this with some other country.
Yeah, the New York Times mentioned regarding this that apparently a technology patent had done that before, had gone to a Native American tribe. I think the nice thing about the Native American tribe is you can keep your operations and everything else. You don't really have to go through a separate government and a separate governmental system. The Native American tribe, you know, they do have the immunity, but they don't have a very complex tax structure, import-export regulations or anything else. They simply own the patent and that's it. So everything else stays in the U.S. and you get that protection.
But they would have, I mean, obviously this is a complex topic. Nobody's going to get $15 million for having a piggy bank, right? I mean, this isn't just a piece of paper stored in a safe somewhere on the reservation. I mean, there are things that go along with this, and I'm sure it's a very complex legal process, but the whole thing, it makes you wonder if at some point they'll end up start looking at how to close these loopholes, right? Because this will be deemed a loophole. You know, there's been gambling on federal or on Native American reservations for years and years and years, and I have to believe that money has to be in the billions coming in.
You think to yourself, okay, this is so
interesting.
Yeah, this is so crazy that it can't hold. But honestly, I mean, if I were a Native American tribe, I would resist. Obviously, first of all, now the dollars are out there. And you realize this is a great way. The $15 million is more than their casino brings in.
Sure.
And so they're looking at this.
You think $15 million is more than their casino brings in?
I do, because that's what the article said.
Well, then this is a fairly small. But, I mean, when you look at some of these casinos across the U.S., I mean, there are some huge ones that I would have to believe make more than that.
Yes.
But nonetheless, it is an interesting loophole.
It is, but I bet it won't close. I think that there are a lot of very thorny issues when the U.S. Tries to renegotiate terms with these Native American tribes. I just don't think it's going to happen. So I think what you'll see is a lot of drug patents moving through this process in order to avoid these two pathways for challenging patents.
So here's the thing. Is this good for America? Because it doesn't sound good for America. It sounds like we're – now, there may be times where you want to go after a patent for totally – legitimate reasons, patent infringement, that sort of thing. But it seems to me like you want a little competition in that space to keep prices down.
Well, yeah, and restasis, again, Weaver's rule, if it's advertised on TV, it's more than $300 a month. They simply will not advertise a nickel and a dime drug. So they're you're talking about $400 or $500 eye drops here, I'm sure. I haven't checked the price on them, but if they're advertised on TV, they're going to be that much. And so, and again, it's $1 billion a year, ballpark, drug. And for that, you will take some extreme steps.
I mean, let's be honest, though, Tony. You'd probably do it for $10 million, wouldn't you? You'd hold it. You'd hold that patent in your house, wouldn't you?
Well, it made me wonder.
On your property.
You know, again, putting segment two and segment three together, you think, well, gee, if we just seceded from the United States,
you mean Kentucky?
Yeah, Eastern Kentucky.
And then we could actually be the patent holding group for the entire country.
Put in casinos. We could, we could sell coal to the U.S. We could do all sorts of stuff. I probably won't live to see the day, but still, holding drug patents seems to be one of the best ways I can think of to make money. You think about it. I mean, none of your tribe members is going to be.
So they may hold the patent, but do they also become the enforcement agency for the patent? Or does the federal government have to enforce that patent?
No, I think our federal government will enforce patents that are in place.
So our federal government will enforce a patent that's in instituted in China.
You make me wish I hadn't even brought this thing in. I thought this was fascinating, and now you're talking about international patent law like I'm an expert on international patent law.
This is actually international land. I mean, it's no different, really.
No, you're right.
It's sovereign land. It's not the U.S. It's some other place.
But the patent was lodged with the U.S. Patent Office, so I think they will enforce it. Now, if the Chinese patent was lodged with the U.S. Patent Office, I don't know why it would be a Chinese patent. But if someone from China lodged something with the U.S. Patent Office, yes. The holder is on the tribal land now, but the patent is a U.S. patent.
So it would seem to me that there'll still be a legal way to go to the U.S. Patent Office and challenge the patent.
Apparently through the courts you can, but this second process only applies to patents brought in by people who are U.S. citizens.
I am glad there will be people far smarter than me that will figure this out.
But I bet it won't change.
Hey, in 2050 we can figure this out, right?
You think of how many memos Rick can write.
Yeah, yeah.
I assure you I will not be writing memos in 2050.
But from now on, anything that happens before 2050 is that's Rick's way of saying it. This is not worth thinking about. It's a, that's
why
too
do you
far
bring
ahead.
This nonsense? No, I'm just kidding.
Okay. Well, speaking of nonsense, and by the way, isn't that a great way to start a section of your radio show?
Great
speaking
segue.
Of nonsense, I've got some great stuff here.
No sense.
This was Medical News and Perspectives. This was the AMA Journal, and it was in September on September 5th. And first of all, let me give you a little bit of background. There are people who illegally or illicitly use performance-enhancing drugs. Now, I'm not talking about anabolic steroids and things that make you stronger or make you run faster. There is an enforcement agency for most of those drugs in most professional sports. They may not be successful, but they try to. But what about cognitive-enhancing drugs, drugs that make you smarter? These are things like the attention deficit hyperactivity disorder drugs. Modafinil was a drug that is used to keep people awake over long periods of time. It was is used for military initially, but it also seems to help people who have narcolepsy and other sleep disorders. It seems to be beneficial for that. A 2013 survey, I'm just giving you some historical background, found about 20% of German surgeons admitted to have taken a prescription for an illicit drug to enhance their cognition at least once. That might be in medical school. It might be modafinil to stay awake after they've been up overnight and to be sharp in the surgery. Another study, around 60% of undergraduates at the University of Maryland had been offered prescription stimulants, again, to enhance their ability to study and their test scores, most of them by friends. If you've been diagnosed with ADHD, this is a regular source of money or your ability to make friends at a medical college, being able to distribute those among your friends. So that is the background. We know that there is a problem. They had this study was done in Germany. A group of 39 highly rated male members of the German Chess Federation played more than 3,000 15-minute chess games against computers that were matched to their skill levels. They either took modafinil, the drug that keeps you awake, methylphenidate, which is a attention deficit hyperactivity drug, or caffeine. The researchers reported that the players taking modafinil and methylphenidate won more games overall than those on caffeine. They did spend more time thinking about their moves. They sometimes would lose on time, but overall they won more games. And the point was, they said, gee, these are chess masters. You say they're already at the top of the game. You couldn't enhance their mental capacities any with performance-enhancing drugs, and yet they did. They then mailed a questionnaire to the Chess Federation people, and they found that about 9% of the respondents actually were using those in real life. So these chess players, one, they played better, measurably better, when they are on performance-enhancing drugs, and they knew that, and they had already been taking them by the survey. So the question comes up then, you know, who shouldn't take performance-enhancing drugs? Let's face it, if I took something other than caffeine, if I took these drugs, this show might actually approach passable decency.
No chance. No chance.
Yeah, you need a talent-enhancing drug.
Whoa, zinger.
All right.
That wasn't even me, Tony.
Know what the lurch looks like over here. Fair enough. It does bring up a question, though.
You want to get together finally?
But, you know, I'm...
Get rid of this. There's a thing in the middle here that's causing problems for both of us.
She's killing the show. She's killing the show. You realize that. Now you finally see it, Rick. Now that it's come over to me, you can finally see just exactly what she's done to the show. This is bad news. The question is, though, you know, if you are an older person and you're starting
it's
to slip a little bit.
Quite enjoyable, I might add.
If you were a hypothetical older person and starting to slip a little bit, not that we know anybody in the studio right now by those terms, if you were a hypothetical older person starting to slip a little bit and you took this drug, is that performance enhancing or performance preserving? You know we use them for people with dementias, Alzheimer's disease. We try to improve their cognition. What's wrong with a middle-aged person improving their cognition? I think, you know, it's happening. Mm-hmm. We don't know exactly how commonly it's happening, but it's definitely happening. And this research says even at the top of your game, even as a chess master, you can still do better on drugs. Reassuring, disturbing, I don't know.
Yeah, but what are the long-term side effects?
That.
It's a whole different.
Something to ponder for a while.
Yes. That is unknown. Rick, can you memo us off the air?
Special thanks. I should have started with the correct format. That's okay. We'll pass. Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Brian Courtney, and to Eric Bilby, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook just do a search for HM Radio Show.
Thanks again to Glennis Board for the Chigger song and for our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC. Thanks for listening to our show, and remember,
Health Matters helps increase your eyes' natural ability to produce tears.
You don't like it, huh?
Yeah, which may be reduced by inflammation due to chronic dry eye. Health Matters did not increase tear production in patients using anti-inflammatory eye drops.
Do not listen to Health Matters if you are allergic to any of the show's hosts. Be careful not to touch the radio to your ear or other surfaces during our show to avoid contamination. You should not listen to Health Matters while wearing contact lenses. If you are wearing contact lenses, they should be removed prior to listening to our show and may be reinserted 15 minutes after the show.
Just as it took time for your dry eye disease to develop, it will take time for Health Matters to help you make some more of your own real tears. And usually only a week.
The most common side effect of Health Matters is a temporary burning sensation. Other side effects include eye redness, discharge, watery eyes, eye pain, foreign body sensation, itching, stinging, and blurred vision.
It is important to understand that Health Matters is not artificial tears. It is a prescription radio show. Artificial tears are over-the-counter lubricants that help moisten the eyes and provide temporary relief, but they do not increase the eye's ability to produce their own tears.
Whatever you do, do not take this stuff lying down. Go ahead and cry it out, and then get out this week and make a healthy change in your life. Tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.